VSAN. Hyperconverged. VSAN. Killer technology.
Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're gonna learn today.
Innovate like a startup, deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's gonna be a great day.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Oh yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Lero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 75. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Arrow, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, friend?
Howdy, sir. Getting my caffeine, getting charged up for the day.
Getting caffeined up on this 75 Diamond edition of the Virtually Speaking Podcast?
Yep. Get some caffeine, get this podcast in, and start packing my bags for Atlanta next week.
Oh, yeah. John and I are going to be at Empower. Actually, this will be airing when we are in Atlanta, so we can listen to ourselves, and we can learn all about the new release of vSAN 6.7.
6.7, that's got a nice ring to it.
Yes, it does. And we've got just the guy to join us and talk about everything that's new in 6.7. He joined us a few weeks back on the Career Day episode. And so joining us for the second time is Mr. Miles Gray. Miles, welcome back to the podcast, friend.
Howdy, guys. How's it going?
Doing well, doing well. Yeah, so before we talk vSAN 6.7, Miles, I did my research on you, and I noticed on your blog, blah.cloud, there was like some cool fast motion videos of you putting together an engine. I didn't know you were such a motorhead.
Yeah, I built a couple of motors now. To my detriment, actually, you should only ever really have to build one because it should work the first time. But yeah, so I've done that a couple of times, and I'm into photography, so I made a couple of time lapses of it and all that kind of stuff. But like I say, it's not really my forte in that I've done it four times now, which means the first three didn't work out so good.
Fair enough. Well, awesome. You're not here to talk about cars. Maybe we can do a separate episode one day on that. Today, we want to talk to you about what's new in vSAN 6.7. John, it seems like launch time. Everything's coming out. I saw VROps had a new version, 7.4 came out. Really pretty interface. vSphere 6.7 is out this week as well. And of course, vSAN 6.7. So man, we're gonna be busy talking launch for the next couple of weeks, I think.
It's all launch all the time, baby.
That's right. All right, Miles, so let's walk through this. Now, I know our good friend Pete Keeler just recently created a What's New in vSAN 6.7 presentation. So why don't we walk through it? Tell us, what's new in vSAN 6.7?
Yeah, sure. So we sort of break down the features in 6.7 into three key areas. We've got our intuitive operations, which is making your day-to-day ops and setup and all that kind of stuff easier. Consistent application experience, which is more predictable and secure app performance, just focusing on stability and that kind of stuff. And then how we've improved our support lifecycle and support experience for existing customers and to help remediation and debugging and that kind of stuff in these kind of environments. And I think the main thing that people are going to notice, or at least your day-to-day sysadmin like we all used to be, is the HTML5 UI, which I'm sure many people will be glad to see because it means we don't have to deal with Flash anymore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got to tell you, that to me seems like one of the most exciting things. I remember when they first came out with H5, I was like, oh, thank God. But yeah, this thing is, it's real now. I'm excited.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was psyched whenever the Flash web client came out because I wasn't a Windows person, and I was like, finally, we can get rid of the C# client.
Oh, yeah.
So I was all behind that thing, and I was like, yep, Flash is great. This is awesome. And then over the next couple of years, you sort of sour from it, and you're like, you know what? I wish I could use this on my iPad or my phone, or, I didn't have to use Flash anymore because it's, be deprecated and all that kind of stuff. So this is going to make a huge difference. It's based on our Clarity UI framework that we have. So it's going to be consistent across products, which is really nice too. So you get that sort of same look and feel throughout the entire product set.
That's one thing that I like you mentioned there is it's based on Clarity, because I've heard people talk often about single pane of glass, and people don't really want necessarily single panes of glass, in my opinion. They want single intuitive experience. And if you have a consistent UI across everything, the fact that you might have a separate browser tab isn't the end of the world, but having, similar design workflows, similar menu types and things like that, icons mean the same thing across products, that really makes just stuff intuitive.
I think you hit the nail on the head there with the workflows. And, if we're focusing on the same icons across products, and we have the same sort of workflows and that kind of thing. It just makes it so much easier. If you know one product, it sort of translates into the others at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it seems like most programs and apps that we use these days have a similar intuitive experience. You can pretty much guess where things are. So is the H5 like a complete port over from the Flash client, or has anything been changed?
So that's interesting. While what we did with the Flash client was we redesigned a lot of workflows as well, but there was a lot of sort of, this is the way we did it before, this is the way we'll do it now. The HTML5 client with regard to 6.7 is we've completely looked at the workflows from start to finish and redesigned them. So we haven't just ported functionality. We've taken it step by step and said, why are we doing this? How can we improve it? How can we use less clicks? How can this be easier to set up, simpler? All that good stuff.
Yeah, and playing with it just last night, you know, one thing I noticed is I needed to set up vSAN. Right click on the cluster, there's a vSAN drop down that'll immediately go in to configure the cluster. Why should I have to go click into a couple places to go start to set up vSAN? Just moving things up to higher level where they need to be, as well as just seeing some of the UI workflows, particularly like around health checks.
Yeah.
Health checks are really sweet, and how they auto expand only the areas that have a warning or a critical alert and only drill into those areas. And when you click on them, you'll see this like whooshing in of the specific elements that it's just really neat, as well as just fast. I mean, I felt like it's 10 times faster.
My single favorite feature about the HTML5 UI is the fact it doesn't grab my mouse and take ownership of it like the Flash one did. That really bugged me in Flash.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's true.
I'm a free man to move across the page as I want to.
Well, and tab actually works reliably. So I can just, if I've clicked somewhere into the frame, I can just tab through and select. And when I'm doing workflows and typing, I can do a keyboard-only workflow.
I suppose it's probably a good idea to highlight at this point that we're doing what we did with the C# client, in that new features are going to be put into the HTML5 client. The Flex client will still be available. So if there are stalwarts out there that are like, no, don't take my Flex client away, you can still use that, but you got to use the HTML5 one for new features.
From my cold, dead hands, the C# client.
Well, I mean, Flash is fundamentally being deprecated by the browsers here in the next year and a half or 2 years. So, I mean, it's got to go. This is actually an interesting scenario where technically we support the Flash client for some older releases longer than you'll probably have access to it.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, even Adobe has abandoned it at this stage. So, I mean, if the writing wasn't on the wall already, there it is.
Yeah, for sure.
And this is going to, I think, have to drive a lot of people to think long and hard about, wait, we can't run a vSphere version for 8 years anymore when all of the browsers refuse to let you open Flash.
I mean, you can always have that one jump box with the specific version of Flash, yes, like you had for Java for your old arrays and stuff like that.
That's
you Java 1.6 on there for that VNX 5100. If you want to run it that way, you can. But yeah, there are easier ways to go about life.
Well, remember, like Java, you had to do increasingly weirder things. You had to manually assign stuff. You had to have proper certs. You had to assign trust level. Like Java Web Start just got progressively harder and harder to use. If you actually look at the roadmaps for the browsers, that's what's happening to Flash already. And we're only halfway through all the annoyances to get you to stop using it. So,
well, one thing I was going to say that I like is that we can now play with others like vRealize Operations. I mean, vRealize Operations in 6.6 had some really cool integration with vSAN. And it's really cool that now that we're using that Clarity framework, we can actually see that inside of vCenter, which is awesome.
Yeah, well, that's really nice. And I was listening to the podcast earlier for the releases, and you had Pete on. He was talking about all these great dashboards that they've done with VROps and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, these pre-built things to help you diagnose and troubleshoot your environment and look at the performance over time and trends and all that kind of stuff. The fact that we're now using HTML5 as well means that direct in the vCenter UI, you don't need to go and use a separate console to access that kind of information. It's just there. First class citizen, really easy to access and find the information that you need to do your ops.
So what about licensing? So how does that work? If I'm a VMware customer, but I have never used vRealize Operations before, can I see this information inside of vCenter?
This is always question number one, isn't it? Is can I have it and is it free? So the answer is yes. If you have a vSAN license, you just plug it into the VROps during install. You get the prepackaged dashboards for free. You can use those. They don't go away. And you can do whatever troubleshooting you want through. You also get a 30-day trial for the rest of the VROps dashboards in there as well. So if you like what you see, you can upgrade your license in version and keep access to those. Otherwise, you just have a perpetually licensed vSAN dashboard set. which is really nice because there shouldn't really be a need to buy a secondary product to monitor something that you already have access to.
I agree with that.
And one of my favorite of the basic operational dashboards, as you would call them, is the troubleshooting one, because it leads you through a workflow of, hey, I've got a problem with performance or whatever on a particular VM. And then it takes you through the steps you need to do to actually say, okay, these are the things that are contributing to the problem. This is how you troubleshoot it. This is the order that you do it in. And it just makes the whole workflow so much simpler.
Awesome. Well, yeah, rounding out the whole intuitive operations experience is one that I know is near and dear to your heart, Miles, is the new support for WSFC.
Absolutely. There's nothing better than killing RDMs dead. And this is one of those features that's going to do that. So,
oh, absolutely.
With 6.7, we now support Windows Server failover clusters on top of vSAN with iSCSI. So that means you don't need to do any more RDMs, and that's for Quorum, shared data disks, whatever it is, scale-out file server, SQL FCI. Naturally, we've always supported doing exchange DAGs and SQL always on availability groups. But up to this point, if you wanted to do SQL FCI or whatever, a disk sharing sort of Quorum service, then you couldn't do that with vSAN. We've now enabled that, and we have fully transparent failover of I/O, even if the host that's serving the LUN goes down. So that's really cool. If you have a Windows Server failover cluster and one of your hosts just dies for whatever reason, could be power failure, link loss, whatever, then your I/O doesn't get interrupted. There is no application error and it just continues to run.
So are you saying that RDMs suck or?
One could say RDMs suck.
I don't have a soundbite for that. All I have is a...
LUNs suck.
Close enough.
Well, the interesting part of this is that it doesn't just support virtualized Windows Server failover clusters. We also support physical Windows Server failover clusters. So if you have some physical Windows boxes and they're clustered, you can move them from your traditional array onto vSAN and you gain the benefits that vSAN provides. And what by that, I mean, you get encryption, deduping, compression, QoS, whatever features that we support are supported with the iSCSI target service on vSAN as well. And that's really cool because what it means is you can take your physical hardware, your physical boxes, and add capabilities to those that would be impossible to do without an array upgrade otherwise.
Yeah, it's nice being able to have SPBM for LUNs, so to speak, in this case. So,
is that a common thing that there are a lot of folks out there that are depending on WSFC these days? It seems like most applications have their own failover technology built inside the app.
Yeah, I think you're right. And even Microsoft technologies have that, right? Like I said, you know, you've got Exchange DAGs and you've got your SQL always on availability groups, but there are some things that don't have that. Or, you know, if an organization chooses not to use it, like your scale-out file server or something on Windows. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a million ways to skin a cat, and this is just, you know, allowing you to choose freely between all of them.
There's a couple of narrow situations where always on availability groups is not supported. I want to say if you do some really weird, unnatural things with linking tables across databases. And so that was one of the blocking issues that would drive people back to what's called FCI, the shared LUN clustering for SQL. The other one was licensing. Previously, you had to have an enterprise license use always on availability groups. And not to turn this into a Microsoft licensing podcast, but in 2016, they unleashed basic availability groups, which would work with the standard license. And that cut the cost to, I don't know, an eighth or whatever for doing shared nothing clustering.
Everyone loves SQL bags.
SQL bags. Wow. You know, I think marketing was in no way involved in that naming, because I can't imagine anyone, at least on our product marketing team, was like, yeah, we're going to call our new product Bag. They'd be like, wow.
Well, see, I think the way they did it was it went AAG before. So they're like, let's just do BAG because it's the next one in the alphabet, right? Why not?
Coming next, CAGs.
So leading on from Windows Server failover clusters, we've got our consistent application experience, which basically allows us or allows customers to experience a more consistent, reliable, stable platform for their applications. And one perfect example of that is our performance improvements for intelligent I/O management. And what this essentially is we have discrete queues now within vSAN for different types of I/O traffic. So what this does is it breaks it down into four categories. We've got our VM I/O, which is, you know, the standard VMDK data I/O.
Yep.
We've got our namespace queue, which is metadata operations, namespace object stuff. There's the resync IO, which is if you have a failure, if you change a storage policy, then there's some resync traffic goes on, and this is the amount of bandwidth that that resync traffic can actually use.
Sure.
And then lastly, we've got our metadata queue, which is just our, you know, VMDK modification operations, creates, destroys, our resync, any metadata kind of stuff. So what this essentially does under the covers is in contention, and it kind of works like network IO control. If you're using shares, you know, you've got sort of a fair use policy application per traffic type. This is the same thing, but for storage. So what we're doing here is we're saying, okay, you can burst up to 100% as long as there's no contention. But as soon as there's contention, shares kick in. And this, what this does is it means we have 20% of our bandwidth under contention is allocated to resync traffic, and the rest will be shared fairly between the other traffic types. But under the instances whenever there's no contention, what this means is any traffic type can use up to 100%, because if there's no contention, then there's no problem.
Ah, okay. Okay. So when everything's going fine, there's no limitations. When things start to get a little busy, you start to manage the traffic and at least place some sort of guarantee on things like resync IO?
Yeah, essentially. And what this means is if you have a massive amount of resyncs going on, it's not going to kill VM traffic. If you have a lot of VM IO traffic, it's not going to kill resyncs. It's a fair usage policy, and it makes a lot of sense.
So you said policy. Does that mean that you're creating the policy, or is this something that's just under the covers?
No, that's a good question, a good catch. That was bad naming on my behalf. This is just functionality that's built into vSAN by default. It's not SPVM. You can't dictate it to SPVM. So this is just under the cover stuff.
So you can't hurt yourself and say, I want 100% for my VM IOQ.
No, this is a new disk scheduler, fundamentally. What was really mind-blowing for me was discovering that bandwidth discovery process and how it actually learns what the disk groups are capable of, both for read and write uniquely, and then can cross-signal that information of content. Like all the different pieces of the distributed object system that vSAN is communicating together. This is a lot of cool, hard engineering.
What this does in the background is we benchmark the disks and see what kind of bandwidth and IO that those are capable of. And it's not just some sort of hard-coded value. It'll continually test them, see what they're capable of. And then we scale that based on the back-end capability of those disk groups. So it's intelligent. It isn't hard-coded. You know, this is a really dynamic and specific to every environment.
I like it.
The other thing that's just nice to note here is, I mean, this is fundamentally what our fourth generation improvement of how we handle resynchronization. We had the original, which was basically just limited by threads. We had kind of the second generation, which was that hard code slider, I think, that showed up around 6.2, update 3 or 6.5. And then in 6.6.1, we had kind of a first generation of this that was more based off of the TCP windowing. All of those, they made improvements, but this is really, this is just a colossal improvement. And I've never seen anything like this in any type of distributed system. This is just really impressive, the amount of work under the hood that went into it.
Yeah, and we've done some more stuff to do with the data path as well, specifically to do with destage operations. We've made them more efficient. It's easier on the system. And what it essentially means is that you have a net gain in VM IO and resync IO performance as a result of that.
And this is something that we've done before. And it's, you know, not to get too nerdy and under the hood here, there's some improvements to the timing of how blocks are destaged. This is going to lead to some improvements in performance across the board. Looking at some of the early benchmarks, it looked like writes, particularly smaller writes, although larger writes did get some improvement. There's some potential pretty big improvements, particularly when there's contention in a cluster. One thing I will say about these improvements to the write destaging, as well as the resynchronization, as well as some other under the hood improvements on how we consolidate data placement when you're doing maintenance actions, this all ties together to speed host doing patching and maintenance operations. And there's already been a lot of improvements. I spoke with one very large customer yesterday who had some really heavy clusters run under a lot of load and a lot of capacity. And they were looking at 30 minutes sometimes to enter maintenance mode and evacuate, you know, necessarily a host. They're looking at 7 minutes now instead of 30. And 6.7 builds even farther on that type of improvement. So as always, results may vary here, but the steady stream of improvements of improving maintenance operations is something that is very top of mind.
Yeah, I like the idea of not just always coming out with a bunch of new bells and whistles and new knobs to turn, but really enhancing and improving the performance on the existing features and characteristics of a product. Seems like there's a lot of those in this release. Like even the next one I'm looking at, the smarter data placement for faster decommissioning. That was a really interesting thing, and I'll let Miles explain sort of what the pitch of it is, but I think it's a really interesting topic.
Yeah, so what this does is consolidates the replicas that live across multiple fault domains while maintaining an FTT compliance. So we don't violate policy at any time here, but what it does is it'll move the components of an object around in the most efficient way possible in order to evacuate that host as quickly as possible. So we're going to evaluate all the components of that object, find the smallest ones, we'll consolidate them if they need to be, and they'll be moved as quickly as possible into the other places. Whereas before we wouldn't look at the object as an overall. Now we're looking at the subcomponent level and we're saying, okay, this entire operation, if the end goal is to evacuate this host, it'll be quicker if we just move X, Y, and Z components out.
This prevents the need in some cases and builds upon some of the improvements in 6.6.1 to avoid ever needing to rebuild part of a RAID tree as part of a maintenance action.
Yeah, the way I see it, it's kind of like you started out by creating this data placement idea. Okay, so I have a policy, and so therefore, I have to split the components into different hosts, and I can still comply with my policy. But now it seems like, oh, wait, there's more to think about. I can actually, you know, not only am I going to stay compliant with my policy, but I'm going to place these in a way that makes the most sense and makes other needs happen more quickly, like decommissioning or putting a host in maintenance mode. To me, it just seems like just enhancing on something that was already there. So more than just having your data being fully available, but it's also just having your system just run faster.
Absolutely. And talking about improving on what we already had there, we've now enabled sparse swap by default. And sparse swap has been in vSAN for a while. We just don't enable it by default. And what it allowed you to do was if you enabled it, it would thinly provision your swap files on the file system. So if you have a very memory heavy workload, you've got a host of 1-2 terabytes of RAM in there, you've got really big meaty VMs, it's going to go ahead and allocate all that space on disk first. So if you have a VM or a couple of VMs that are running, you've got maybe a terabyte used in a host, it's going to allocate 1 terabyte plus whatever the fault tolerate policy is. So FTT1, it's going to be 2 terabytes of disk space just to satisfy a swap policy. Now, you might know that your host is never going to run out of memory space because you've way over allocated on RAM, you're not over committing, you're sure that it's going to be sweet whenever it comes to overhead and that kind of thing. You could enable sparse swap in the past, and that would thinly provision your swap objects. This is now the default in vSAN. So if you move to 6.7, all the swap objects are going to be created thinly on your data store, and we're not going to use up all that space for something that probably won't happen.
Yeah, and in previous versions, I don't think the swap file even listened to the policies, and now it actually will be compliant with your policy. So you can configure this inside of SPBM, right?
No, you're absolutely right. Before, we would only allocate an FTT1 policy to a swap object, whereas now, if you attach a policy to your VM that's FTT2 or specific fault tolerance method or whatever, that's going to get mirrored onto the swap object as well, which is really cool.
Sweet.
And another one is we made a bunch of changes to Stretch Cluster in this release as well. And these are more focused on efficiency and stuff like that, other than like what Pete was saying earlier on, you know, adding features all the time. This release is very much we're making stuff more stable. It's more resilient. We can tolerate more kinds of failures and all this good stuff. So that's what these sort of tie into as well. One of them in particular, and we've had a lot of requests for this, is the witness traffic separation on Stretch Cluster. You could do this on 2-node for a while now. And what it essentially means is you can have a VM kernel port that replicates your traffic. And then you have another VM kernel port that just does your metadata traffic up to your witness. This wasn't supported on Stretch Cluster up until now, but right, we've got it. So what this means is you can have separate subnets for your data and your witness traffic. And they'll just go out separate VM kernel ports, which is pretty nice if you have particular networking requirements that would need that.
Yeah, that's smart.
Whenever I think of those like AB, you know, fiber channel networks, I just imagine like, you know, I think someone made an image of this with like a giant wizard standing in the middle with the staff, you know, the Gandalf, the gray, or Cormac, you know, the white.
The Cormac,
you know, thou shalt not, you know, pass, like, you know, separate these fabrics. But
yeah, and fabric separation is sort of an old school way of looking at things. Like that's an old school fault tolerance sort of throwback to fiber channel days where you had an A fabric and a B fabric. With Ethernet, it doesn't really work that way. You've got routing and other kinds of intelligence higher up the stack to take care of that kind of stuff for you. So if you want to do fault tolerance based on separate fabrics, you can do that now. We've got faster failover to it with fast RDT failover. Previously, we would use the TCP timeout to fail data traffic over from one to the other, whereas now we've improved the speed of failovers for completely isolated networks a lot. For people that want to run their vSAN networks on separate subnets, completely segregated switches, air gap networks, all that good stuff. And again, in relation to stretch clusters, we've reduced a lot of the inter-site traffic requirements as well, especially during resync operations. What we do now is if there's a resync required across sites, we'll make one copy of the data, mirror it over onto one of the hosts, yeah, and then do the resync from there. So this has been a thing in networking for a while. You could do it with VXLAN with a thing called head-end replication. And what this would essentially do is you elect one host, it would send the traffic to there, and then it would distribute via unicast within that particular fault domain.
Yeah.
It's a similar sort of idea that we've got now with data replication. So we take the data from one site, replicate it over to a single host on the other one, and then that host is sort of the leader for that site, and he replicates it amongst his peers.
Yeah. Why would, if it's already on that side, why would you replicate that over your inner site link when you don't have to?
Exactly. And that's what we're improving upon in this release. And it lowers your bandwidth requirements for ISL and all that kind of stuff during resync traffic. And it's generally just, you know, it's more efficient.
Awesome. Yeah. So it seems like, as we already mentioned, there's a ton of little tweaks or enhances into the way, you know, vSAN, you know, there's an old clip, John says, vSAN is smarter than you. And yeah, that's what it is, right? It's just getting smarter in the way it handles things, whether it's replication, whether it's handling destaging, whether it's spar swap, all that stuff seems to be just getting smarter. I like that. So the third category that we talked about was this whole enhanced support experience. What's in there? What's new?
So the enhanced support experience, there's been a lot of improvements we've been working on steadily. One of this is extending some of the capabilities of vSAN Support Insight in terms of its ability to, I've always kind of compared it to the Eye of Sauron, like peering into the environment, keeping an eye on things. But its ability,
but in a less evil way.
Yes.
Exactly.
It's looking out for you.
We've put a giant, you know, concave lens or whatever in front of it to focus it even deeper. But we've made improvements in terms of that. The other thing, you know, also in terms of this is just staffing up teams. There's a lot more people on the vSAN escalation teams that are within GSS. I've personally been out to two of the three major sites,
yeah,
and actually visited and done some training with these groups. They're very sharp. They're very capable in terms of, you know, working with them.
We do automatic data collection and stuff like that that's pushed up to GSS to help them aid you troubleshoot your environment as well. If something goes wrong, the data gets sort of peeled off your environment. It's all obfuscated, so we don't see host names or anything like that. So you don't need to worry about privacy or anything. We can only see into your environment once we call you, and then you give us your
obfuscation map.
That's the word.
It's a tough word.
I can't spell it. I can't say it unless someone else is having difficulty.
I don't think it's English.
I did the vSAN Support Insight demo video, and I kept having to say that word. It was like obfuscated. So yeah. Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, vSAN Support Insight is very cool. It's sort of a quiet release in 6.6.1. If you haven't heard of it, by all means, Google vSAN Support Insight. There's some good information out there for it. But yeah, like Miles said, it's a way to collect configuration information and errors without actually collecting any personal data or even any like server names. It just literally obfuscates the the content. I think I got it right. Obfuscates the content and puts it in a generic way so the support team can start troubleshooting the minute you're on the call, as opposed to having to collect that data.
I think one of the most powerful things with relation to that is we don't have to rely on customers' monitoring of their environment, which might be up to scratch, it might be subpar. You know, we now collect the data that we need to troubleshoot an environment. So we collect performance stats and all that kind of stuff. So we don't have to ask the customer, hey, what was happening in your cluster prior to this happening? We can just see straight away, we have the information, we have the data there that we can go, okay, we'll drill down into this. Oh, right, this SSD was seeing a load of latency because it was failing for whatever reason. We get a historical context of the entire event. We don't have to try and dig through log files after the fact.
Well, that's always that fun experience of like, oh, it's, you know, you've got something that's crash and burn and you're like, okay, we got to scrape logs off the floor. Like, no, it's having that, that before Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall, as I call it, of the logs, performance configuration telemetry is nice. The other area of improvements of support is there are more health checks, as well as the health checks keep getting smarter. If you ever used health checks back when it was just kind of a weird flingy plugin back on the 6.0 update one days, you'd have like one host going to would go offline for a patch, and like you would get a sea of red of, you know, well, not only is the host down, but its network, its vMotion is down and everything else, you know, and I can't tell what firmware, all these other things. And we've gotten a lot more intelligent about how to roll up those alarms. So you get one alarm, that's what it probably is, rather than 12 alarms when a host does, you know, has one thing not functioning.
I like that in particular as well, in that it clears down alerts now. So you don't go in the next day and go, what are these 20 alerts? What has happened to my environment? Because it will remediate them automatically whenever the problem is no longer a problem. So you only see what's relevant to your cluster at that point in time. And that's really nice from an ops perspective. You don't get this sort of wall of red where you're like, whoa, what's happened here? Because it's only what's relevant now.
Yeah.
Well, and what's also cool is some of the health checks will only show up if they're relevant to you. So if there's a health check that's specific to a given controller or configuration, if you're not in that configuration, that health check is not going to appear at all within the UI. And on the online health checks, where that's where we leverage, make sure you've got CIP enabled, you're not going to pull down new health checks that are not relevant for your environment based on your configuration. And I like that whole only surfacing things that are relevant makes things a lot easier rather than having just a sea of things to go dig through.
And one of the nice things, like what John was saying there about not having to go into an environment and scrape logs off of it, is that we can dynamically resize the core dump partition now on the boot disk. So if you have a host that's got too much memory to dump onto the standard core dump partition, it'll automatically extend the core dump partition on the boot disk in order that if a host PSODs for whatever reason or crashes, all the logs are persisted on the disk whenever it reboots, so that GSS can actually have a full core dump to look at and really dive into what happened in that and not have to worry about, oh, were the core dumps actually collected, because we know they're there.
Yeah, yeah.
That was an issue, particularly with high memory configurations in the past when you're using embedded devices or SD cards. Still much prefer M.2, you know, your small little flash dumb stick, I call them flash drives, going forward for boot devices. But I know a lot of people out there have got SD cards and USB and, you know, small devices on those embedded installs. And this automatic core dump resizing will significantly help them from a supportability.
Yep, yep, yep.
Pete, I just want to stress, by the way, real quick here, we haven't talked about the most important feature of this release.
What's that?
And performance service is going to be enabled by default.
What?
And our commitment to fewer clicks, since 99.9% of people, you know, want this service on, there's that 0.1% who hates knowing what their performance is. It is now enabled by default when you set up a cluster. My apologies out to the 0.1% of you who actively want to be blissfully unaware of what your performance is, but it's now enabled by default.
I don't want to know. I don't want to know. Yeah. Do they exist?
And it helps your support experience as well, because that all that information gets pushed up to GSS in case you call them in, so they can see what's happened in your environment. So this makes a ton of sense to have enabled by default.
Sweet, sweet, sweet. All right, we're rounding up here. Real quick, I know there is, of course, there's the fact that vSAN 6.7 now offers support for 4KN devices in vSphere and vSAN, which is very cool. But John, I wanted to ask you lastly about this one. And Miles, I know you're from Ireland. You can chime into this one as well. But the FIPS 140-2 validation, John, what's new there?
So we've got it. We have FIPS 140-2 validation. So for federal, U.S. federal, and I think the Canadians also use that, which makes sense, you know, 51st state and all. Sorry, Ken. we actually have, and it's not something cheesy like, oh, we're using FIPS 140-2 drives or something. No, we actually have a cryptographic module that we submitted and has validation. What's really fun is this has actually been out there for a while on, I believe it's NIST's website. So you actually could have known that vSphere 6.7 was coming if you had found this obscure document that included our validation, because it's been up there for months. So, ha ha ha, no one found it. Yeah.
Nice.
Now, this is something to note, that this is both for vSphere encryption as well as vSAN encryption, since we're using that same cryptographic stack. So for people who have that requirement for data at rest encryption, I know some even in the commercial space will look for that as a symbol of, this is, you know, So there's been proper sanity checks done on this encryption. And that really helps you protect, you know, again, against, you know, data leakage and so forth like that, as that becomes increasingly expensive. And our, I know our friends over in Europe may not necessarily care about FIPS 140-2, but encryption at rest is a big top of mind thing with some of the GDPR concerns.
What are you talking about? Federal is a big deal over here?
Just don't not U.S., right?
Federal, or do you call
just not U.S. federal.
Yeah, they have their own federal.
I was just curious, do they use that term?
No, we just call it government.
So, John, I would imagine all HCI vendors have this, right?
This is actually the first HCI vendor to have a full FIPS 140-2 validated solution.
Oh, okay.
Beware imposters. You know, this is something people will just go out and, you know, go download a sticker or a logo and throw it on a slide or a web page. But no, we're at VMware, we actually take this stuff seriously. So.
You mean like those stickers you got on websites back in the day? And it was like, your checkout is secure. It has Norton on it. Of course it's secure.
Yeah, I like screenshot someone else. Yeah, no, there may have been some of that going on in the industry here with encryption and FIPS 140-2 specifically. But no, we've got the real deal here. So
good to know. Good to know. All right, that seems like a pretty good summary of what's going on in vSAN 6.7. If you want to learn more about it, go to storagehub.vmware.com or hol.vmware.com. You can try it out yourself. Miles, thanks for joining us, buddy. John, you have anything else before we let Miles go?
I was going to say, what car are you driving right now?
Good question.
What car am I driving right now?
Yeah.
It's a bit personal. I have
you're a single guy, right? You're a single guy. I know that.
Yeah, you're a single guy. You have to have a cool car. I've got a you know, a badass six-speed manual shifting Camry 4-cylinder. So
you know what? I actually went the opposite. Normally I would be the one with the manual and you guys would be the ones with the automatics, but I went dual clutch this time, so I've got an Audi RS3 affectionately called Gunter. So he hangs out outside most of the time because I don't need to drive anywhere, so he's there to look pretty.
That's a family car though, isn't it? That's a beautiful car.
Oh yeah, it's a four-door, so it's clearly for families. It's really kid friendly and all that kind of stuff, which is,
well, ladies, you heard it here. There's a single guy in Ireland driving a really fancy Audi with four doors, so go get him. All right, well, that music tells us it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A huge thanks to Miles for talking some vSAN 6.7 with us. We'll be back next week, but until then, bye for now.
Saying killer technology.
Oh yeah. I'm glad I know his card is named Gunter.
Gunter.
After the German disco pop singer.
And is your car a girl?
No, it's Gunter, man.
Okay.
The other one is called Morticia. Morticia is the mini that has the engines that die all the time.
Ah. aptly named.
Absolutely.
Enough of this jibber jabber.